So today's Teisho will be on case four in the Heikigan Roku, the Blue Cliff Record, the Blue Rock Collection. Case four is Tokusan Visits Isan. Engo's introduction. The blue sky, the bright sun, there is no distinguishing east and west. Time and causation, medicine, must be given to the sick. Tell me, is it best to let go or to hold fast? See the following. Main subject. Tokusan came to Isan's temple. Carrying his pilgrim's bundle under his arm, he crossed the lecture hall from east to west and from west to east. Then, staring around, he said, "Moo, moo," and went out. Tokusan reached the gate, but then he said to himself, "I should not be in a hurry." So he dressed formally and entered a second time to have an interview. Isan was sitting in his place. Tokusan, holding up his kneeling cloth, said, "Osho." Isan made as if to take up his whisk. Then Tokusan gave a shout, swung his sleeves, and went out. Tokusan, with his back turned to the lecture hall, put on his straw sandals and went off. In the evening, Isan asked the chief monk, "The new arrival, where is he?" The chief monk said, "When he went out, he turned his back on the lecture hall, put on his sandals, and went away." Isan said, "Someday that fellow will go to an isolated mountaintop, establish a hermitage, and scold the Buddhas and abuse the ancestors." Secho's verse, the first seeing through, the second seeing through, frost on top of snow, great risk of slipping. Like General Hiki, he entered the enemy's camp. He narrowly escaped. He made a dash for it, but he was not let alone. Alas, he is seated among the weeds on the isolated mountaintop. I want to thank everybody for coming to practice Zen this morning and for sitting so well, so still. Really wonderful to practice like that. There's a lot going on in this koan, so let me go through the details one more time. Tokusan is coming to visit Isan's temple. He's on a pilgrimage. He's carrying his pilgrim's staff and his pilgrim's bundle. And in Chinese and Japanese culture, pilgrims carry a staff that has a trident on the top of the staff and three rings, or sometimes it's more than three, but it's three rings hanging off, okay? So that's a pilgrim's staff, this staff with three rings. And he's on a pilgrimage and he has his pilgrim's bundle. He's coming to Isan's temple. He crossed the lecture hall from east to west and west to east. Then staring around, he says, "Moo, moo, nothing, nothing." And he goes out. Then as he reaches the gate, he has a second thought. He says, "I shouldn't be in such a hurry." So he dresses formally, takes off his informal robes. He puts on his formal robes and enters a second time to have an interview with Isan. Isan's sitting on his mat. And Tokusan, holding up his kneeling cloth, this cloth you put in front of you when you kneel, said, "Osho," in other words, master. Isan made as if to take up his whisk. Then Tokusan gave a shout, swung his sleeves, and went out. Tokusan, with his back turned on the lecture hall, put on his straw sandals and went off. In the evening, Isan asked the chief monk, that new monk, where is he? And the chief monk said he went out, he turned his back on the lecture hall, put on his sandals, and went away. So So, I mean, what we might expect, is that Isan would be angry, right? That Isan would say, well, what a rude person. You know, he came to my temple. He put on, you know, he came to my temple. He entered my Dharma hall, you know, and then he puts on this bizarre act and he goes away, turns his back on all of us and leaves. And instead he praises him. So that's the koan. It's like, what was that all about? Why did Isan praise Tokusan? And why didn't Tokusan just do what you would expect him to do? He's visiting the temple. He could present himself to Isan. He could say, I'm Tokusan, I'm on a pilgrimage. I'm so happy to be at your temple. Isan would say, well, welcome, and please choose a bunk in the dormitory, and see you at, you know, 4:30 for afternoon sutras or something like that. So this koan is really about not just Isan's response, but Tokusan's actions. Tokusan has come all this way, right? All this way. Who knows how many miles he's walked to get to Isan's temple. You know, in the old days before they had trains, you know, all these monks and nuns would walk to their main temple to do sesshin. And sometimes it was like many days of traveling to get to sesshin. The great Chinese master Xu Yun was relatively old before it was old before he had had his great awakening experience. He was in his 50s, and he set off to a temple, at Nanhua Temple, in the middle of winter. And he walked for like 5 days. He fell in the water. He slipped off the bridge and fell in the water. When he got to the temple, he was sick. This actually in Japan too. You know, all those monks would not do sesshin at their local parish temples. They would all go to the temple. They'd all walk some distance, you know, sometimes like 50 miles, 100 miles to do sesshin. So Tokusan has come all this way to do sesshin with Isan, or to do something with Isan. And as soon as he arrives at the temple, he starts to leave. And then he has second thoughts, and he thinks, well, maybe that's too abrupt. And he goes in to see Isan, he's supposed to spread his kesa, his bowing cloth, on the ground, do some bows and have this conversation. But he doesn't. He turns around and leaves. So, you know, it's so easy to practice Zen. Let me say, there's different ways to practice Zen. You know, one way to practice Zen is to practice it for your health, at your mental and physical health. So if you do Zazen, it really does benefit your physical and mental health. You know, we do, you know, there's a therapeutic dimension to meditation practice. There's no question. You know, people who take the time to do Zazen are, I think, physically healthier and certainly mentally healthier. You know, nothing wears people out more than stress and, you know, overthinking everything. People get caught in these loops, right? So many people get caught in these loops. You go to a job interview, and you prepare for the job interview, and you go in, and the interviewer asks you this question that's out of left field, and you don't have time to formulate a good answer, and you start to make an answer, and then you stumble, and then you falter, right? And when you leave the interview, you know, you go home on the train, or you drive home on the Garden State, and you're just you're just rehearsing that conversation over and over again. And you say, why didn't I say that? I had a good answer, I just didn't say it. I had a friend of mine, Tony was his name. Tony had to take his doctoral examinations in English twice because he failed the first time. And he wasn't failed by his committee, he sort of failed himself. He got into the exam and he started basically answering the question. And about halfway through his answer, he became so distressed, he became so unhappy with his answer, and he actually asked the committee to call it off, and he was going to quit. And he was really like a very hardworking guy, very smart. But after this, it took him like all summer to recover from his failed PhD exam. And I was a good friend of his, so I knew all about this. And fortunately, his committee got him to come back in and retake the exam. And he did get his PhD. He did a great dissertation. He had already written the dissertation, so he should have been able to do the exam. You know, what happened to him was that he was so demanding of himself that he had imagined he would go in to the interview, into the doctoral exam. And, you know, he had a set of questions he anticipated. And when people asked him questions he didn't anticipate, he melted down. He really got so distressed and felt so, he felt like he screwed the whole thing up. He sort of took himself out. They probably would have just said, well, do you have a better answer? And he could have gone on. But he wanted this perfect answer. So we all, you know, this is like a classic, right? We get into these mental loops and we defeat ourselves a lot of the time. And if we do Zazen, you know, you learn how not to do that. It's so wonderful, right? It's so wonderful to just sit down on the cushion and watch your breath and let all of that go and just be in the moment. And that's a wonderful way to practice. That's a wonderful way to practice Zen. And it has all of these therapeutic benefits psychologically. And if you just practice Zen for the physical and psychological benefits, I think that's a wonderful thing. That's fantastic. But when I think back to the story of the Buddha, I realize that, you know, practicing that way is fine if that's what you want to do. But something really important gets lost when we practice meditation or we practice Zen or Buddhism for its like therapeutic benefits, right? You know, if you remember the story of the Buddha, you know, this is according to legend, you know, he was living in a palace. And basically, he was living a highly protected life, and he had the opportunity to sort of get out of the palace and see a person who was sick, very sick, maybe with something like a smallpox or something, some deforming disease like that. He saw somebody who was old, and he was sort of protected. According to legend, he was protected from seeing old people. And then he saw a corpse. And this, so according to the legend, the story, this so troubled him that he decided to leave his wife and his infant child and his parents and go in search of wisdom. Now, you know, I really don't think that's how it could have been, right? I mean, a lot of scholarship says that the Buddha's father wasn't a prince. He was a member of the aristocracy, but the Shakya Republic, where the Buddha was from, was like a almost like a democracy, right? They had a parliament building. His father was probably like the Speaker of the House in the parliament building. His father was a legislator, you you know, and respect it, maybe like the prime minister or something like that. At any rate, he wasn't a king. And I think it's very unlikely that the Buddha never saw anybody sick or never saw a corpse or never saw somebody old, right? I think that's very unlikely. But at any rate, you know, the Buddha was troubled by ordinary life, by the conditions of ordinary life. Something in his life opened his eyes to, like, the precariousness of things, you know, the precariousness of things. And also the vulnerability of people, how much they suffer. So if you don't look around too carefully, right, the world seems like a really happy place, you know. But if you start to look around, you see sources of suffering everywhere you look, right? A good friend of mine is, I have three different friends who are undergoing treatment for cancer. One is only in early 50s, one is in, you know, mid 60s, and one is in his 70s. And I see these people regularly. My wife actually sometimes drives one of these people to chemotherapy. You know, it's so challenging, right, to go through something like that. I can talk about other things. My sister has like a son who has who's on the spectrum, right? And that's been very challenging for her. I think it's been a challenge every day since she had this child. I can remember going to her house after the child was born, and he was physically like a beautiful child. He looked like a Hummel figurine, one of those little ceramic children you see. Very beautiful child. And it took her a while to realize maybe that he was not neurotypical, as they say. And she you know, had to cope with all kinds of things. I mean, he's very, very challenging, you know, just like everyday social interactions can cause somebody on the spectrum, like a lot of emotional difficulty, right? A lot of emotional difficulty. I think that the Buddha must have seen this. You know, something, his position in life was very privileged. He was very protected from suffering, but I think he began to notice, you know, that there's a lot of unhappiness and suffering. And eventually he became so aware of this that he left home. I mean, you may have been following in the newspaper that Kate Middleton, who is the, you know, this Princess of Wales, isn't that her title? You know, she's 42 years old and she has cancer. They've been trying to hide it. You know, I think that kind of precariousness must have become obvious to the Buddha, to Siddhartha Gautama. You know, when you have children, you want them to be normal, so-called. You know, you want them to be a well-adjusted, healthy, world-affirming, optimistic. And, you know, that doesn't always work out. And, you know, when you marry somebody, you don't want a decade and a half into your marriage to have them die from cancer, right? So I think all of these things moved the Buddha to set off on this path, right? He studied with these great meditation teachers. He worked really hard. He almost starved himself to death. You know, one of the things that I think is so interesting is that after the Buddha had his great awakening experience, he didn't go home. You know, that's something that's always interested me, right? I mean, after the Buddha had his great awakening experience, he didn't say, okay, now I have seen it. I have seen enlightened mind face to face. He called it the deathless. Now I'm going to go home. And he could have gone back to his family and taken up his father's job in the parliament and so on and so on. But he didn't do that. He didn't do that. You know, the Buddha never went home. Isn't that interesting? I think that's such an interesting fact. He did sometimes go back to the town where he was from, but he didn't stay in his father's home. His wife eventually, after their son, Rahula, was an adult, his wife joined the Sangha. She became a nun. His son became a nun, you know. And they all lived in this monastic way. You know, the people pass by these details, but that's such an interesting thing. Lots of the Buddha's followers were not monks and nuns. Lots of the Buddha's followers were lay people. And if you read the Pali Sutras, a lot of the lay people in the sutras actually have great awakening experience. See? So the Buddha had students who were financiers. One of his students was a very famous financier who donated all this land to the Sangha. He had several kings would come to see him. He had lots of prominent people in his time who were his students and studied with him. And he didn't say, give up your throne, shave your head and become a monk. He offered them all kinds of advice, and according to the Pali Sutras, like a number of these people became fully awakened people. So it's certainly possible. I think the message is that it's really possible to become a fully awakened person in the context of everyday life. But it's still interesting to me that the Buddha didn't himself come back and live in the palace, right? And become a husband again, you know? He remained like this person on the outside of society. He remained a home leaver. See, a home leaver. That's what it's called. Bhikkhu or bhikkhuni means somebody who asks for alms or home leaver. So the Buddha was troubled by suffering and the precariousness of life. He set out on this journey. He had a great awakening experience, and he did bring it back to people. He taught people from every level of society. You know, and if you read the early sutras, he goes in and talks to farmers. He talks to villagers. His followers came from like all walks of life. He had people who were, many people from his own family became members of the Sangha. He took a great interest in like the political life of his time. He took a great interest in morals and ethics. You know, when he would meet people, he would say, if you're a husband, these are your moral obligations. If you're a wife, these are your moral obligations. If you have children, you need to do this, this, and this. So he was definitely interested in everyday life and the way people live their everyday lives. And there's in the Pali Sutras, there's lots of accounts of people coming to him and saying, you know, since I've been following your path, my life has gotten so much better, you know. So it's definitely the case that just practicing Zen for your life, for your everyday practical life, just practicing Buddhism for your everyday practical life is a wonderful decision. And if you do it, it will really help you. I mean, I myself was fascinated by Buddhism, but you know, the reason I started practicing Zen or stayed with Zen practice was because it helped me so much cope with graduate school, marriage. I have, for a long time, I had an anxiety disorder, I guess you would say. All of these things had helped. But I'm still wondering why the Buddha didn't go home. See, why the Buddha didn't put on his princely robes and go back into the palace and become a father again and so on. And I myself live in a house. I drive a car, I have a job. So being in the world is really important to me too. But I think if we just practice for those things, we miss something really crucially important. There's a word in English which some people don't like, but which I think is really important. This word is the transcendent. Transcendent. The transcendent is like the beyond here, you could say. Transcendent means goes beyond. And I think Buddhism is all about, I think that the heart of Buddhism is encountering the transcendent, And it's difficult for us to encounter the transcendent because we're constantly closing it off, right? So maybe I can give you an example. When I was in high school, I actually liked to study. I liked to read. I even got interested in mathematics. I really got interested. At first I was terrible in math, and then I got really interested in it. But my high school career was ruined by my getting really good grades, right? So when I was in the 10th grade, I started getting all these A's. And at the end of the 10th grade, I got I had the highest GPA in my high school that year. And I got an academic trophy. And they, at the end of the year, they were giving trophies to everybody, and I got an academic trophy. And I took it home to my mother, and she put it in the living room, in this prominent place. So after that, I had to get another trophy, right? So I actually began to study more and more. And the more I studied, the better my grades got. Every year, I'm not boasting. I was the valedictorian of my high school class. Every year I would get a trophy and I would take it home. I had so little pleasure in any of this by the time I graduated from high school. The things that I had loved to do, read, they all were sort of poisoned by my wanting to be the top student in my high school. So look at what I'd done. I'd taken something that I loved doing, and I completely made it like a prison for myself. See, I hope that's making sense. And we do that to ourselves all the time, right? We create these artificial standards or these artificial standards or artificial expectations. And then we pursue those, with all of our energy. And then we keep upping the ante on ourselves, right? And then when we fail to meet those goals, we feel terrible. I can remember in high school when I would sometimes get a lower than an A. I would get a B on something. And I would come home and I would be so upset. It was I must never do that again. I must never get another B. So that was poison for my life, right? Really, really. And, I think we can all do this. I have a friend of mine who is an artist in Seattle, And he's one of the best watercolorists I have ever known. If his stuff is magical. He actually trained in the Seattle Zen Center when I was going to the Seattle Zen Center. And you know, at one point in his life when I, you know, he was so, he felt so sad about where his quote unquote career had gone. Because, you know, he's like this incredible artist and they would have shows and sometimes his work wouldn't sell. Sometimes the show wouldn't get reviewed in like the local art newspapers. And it caused him so much unhappiness that his art, he sort of lost touch with his art, you know, sort of like lost. I also think this can happen in human relationships, right? You know, it's like there's a wonderful author. I think I've talked about him before. His name is Andrew Solomon. He's written this book called Far From the Tree. And it's about the relationship between parents and their children. And I myself have no children, so I'm not going to speak on that subject personally, but I think what Andrew has to say is really interesting. You know, Andrew Solomon grew up in a Jewish family, a rather traditional Jewish family, and he was gay, and at a time when that was like unspeakable. And, you know, when he came out of the closet, it created so much emotional distress for his parents, especially for his mother. It was just like, it was like a crisis. And it took years to get over this crisis. So Andrew's writing this book, and the title, as I say, is Far From the Tree. You know, the expression in English is, the apple doesn't fall far from the tree. And that means basically that your kids are going to be pretty much like you, see? It's like the saying means, you know, if you're like this, your son is going to be like this. If you're like this, your daughter's going to be like this, because the apple doesn't fall far from the tree. And Andrew says, you know what? The apple always falls far from the tree. Always. See? He says, you know, parents have children thinking, and he actually is a parent himself now. He and his partner have several children. I think they're biological children, as a matter of fact. And he said, you know, children, his hypothesis is, I don't have kids, so I don't know, but he says, you know, when people have children, they kind of think, I'd like to carry on the traditions, the family traditions. I'd like to have a son or a daughter. You know, and we imagine, you know, the son or daughter will be somehow like an apple off the old tree, right? And Andrew says, you know, that's not how it is, right? It's not how it is. We have kids who are totally surprising, he says, who aren't anything like us, and it causes all this distress and upset. And I think he's speaking from experience. He has lots of cases of this. In fact, he considers cases of people like, he considers the case of like people who are like musicians who have a child who's born deaf, right? That actually happens to people. And he also has a case of deaf parents who have a hearing child. You know, deaf people have a culture of their own. It's like their own culture. They don't necessarily even want to have like cochlear implants. They want to be deaf, and they have this whole culture, and they feel it's very rich, and they've created it. So when you have a child who can hear, you know, that's like that's a real like a challenge to your whole culture. So, you know, basically his parents had a great deal of distress because they had all of these expectations, right? That he was going to be, you know, he would have a bride, he would have a wedding, there would be the grandchildren, they could be the bubby, you know, for their grandchild, and so on. And, you know, they saw all of that vanish and they were in such emotional distress. So I think what we do to we do this to ourselves all the time. In fact, it's probably inevitable. Another example, a good friend of mine is a editor. She's retired from the book business, but she used to sit with us a long time ago. She used to sit with us, and one morning we used to have Sunday sitting up in northern New Jersey, in Stanhope, New Jersey, a lovely place. Actually, it was even earlier than that. It was in near Clinton, New Jersey. Anyway, one morning after sitting, she said, "Oh," I said, "How was your sit?" And she said, "Well, it was a little tough. I stayed up last night. I was working," and she's an editor. And I said, "What were you working on?" She was saying, "I was trying to get this book into the, you know, get this editing this book done." And I said, "Oh, who was the author? Anybody I know?" And she said, "Tom Clancy." I don't know if you know who Tom Clancy is, but he's like this super best-selling author. It was like, "Oh my God, you're the editor for Tom Clancy." And she even said yes. And she said, "In fact, we even write some of his chapters." He gives us the manuscript and she says, "You know, basically that's it. He's moved on, you know." And sometimes they feel that another chapter's needed and their team can write in his style and fix it up. So, you know, basically, she was telling me over coffee after that, she said, "You know, writers are," she said, "unless you're Tom Clancy, everybody's miserable, right?" She said, "Before you, when you're writing your book, you think, oh my God, will I ever find a book agent? When you find a book agent, right, then you think, oh my God, will I ever get a good press? You know, when you get a good press, or a press anyway, then you think, oh my God, well, any, you know, is the book going to sell, right? And then if the book sells, you think it's sold, but not as many as somebody else, right? You know, this is how, notice what you do. You poison the whole thing, right? You poison it all. And one could just go through thousands of examples of this, right? I mean, I've talked about this before. When I was young, I liked music. I have never actually watched this is not a criticism. I have never actually finished a football game in my life. I've never watched a whole football game, ever. It's not a put down. I just said, can't watch football, right? So when I was young, my father was really worried about me because I liked to read. I wasn't physically aggressive, and so he actually bought me like a football outfit. He wanted me to be interested in football, I just sat in the closet. I think I gave it to my brother who was interested in football. You know, so disappointing for Dad that I wasn't that kind. My father liked to hunt. I'm sorry to say, he actually liked to hunt, like kill things, right? So I myself have never shot anything. You know, again, my brother really liked that. So apple fell far from the tree, caused my father a lot of emotional distress, as a matter of fact, you know. So we do this all the time. We can take something we love, like writing, poetry, and by setting up these arbitrary standards, we can make it a miserable experience. So many writers are alcoholics because they do this. If you read about Hemingway, you know, Hemingway is such a great writer. I teach The Sun Also Rises often, and it's so beautifully done. You know, and Hemingway was so jealous of every other writer, and he would, if he didn't win the prize, or he didn't get the lead review in the New York Review of Books or something, this is before the New York Review of Books, but he would be so agonized, you know, he would start drinking and acting up. And, you know, eventually this really had devastating consequences. So we do this to ourselves, right? So I think, you know, this is a koan about somebody whose behavior is strange, right? You go all this way to see Isan, Toka-san walks for 5 days, let's say, to Isan's temple. And he gets there, and he basically is about to turn around and leave, right? And he says, well, that's too abrupt. I'll go in. And he goes in, but he doesn't actually have a conversation with Isan. He presents himself. He expresses his respect for Isan. He turns around and he leaves and he's gone. And Isan says, oh, you know, that's somebody who really has it. He really understands. See? In other words, you know, it's not about, you know, we create, you know, when we want the Nobel Prize for the novel we wrote and we don't get the Nobel Prize, you know, that can be a crisis. But, you know, if you can free yourself from wanting the Nobel Prize, right, suddenly your life becomes so much bigger. You realize, who cares about the Nobel Prize? See, who cares about the Nobel Prize? If you look at the list of people who have won Nobel Prizes in literature, a lot of those people are not read. If you go back and you look and you look at like best-selling books from the 1920s, right? If you go back and look at those, you've never heard of any of those guys, people who were like at the top of their game, right? It's like when you are writing for the Nobel Prize, or you're writing to be praised by the critics, or you're writing for, you're gradually cutting yourself off from the thing that's so liberating about your writing. And that's like getting outside of yourself and connecting with something bigger than yourself. You know, I've been teaching poetry this semester. I do the intro to poetry class. And, you know, so many poets say, you know, this is not about the lines on the page. This is not about the words. It's the experience of, they say, it's the experience of transcendence. It's like getting beyond myself, getting outside of these artificial boundaries that I create around myself. It's the transcendence, you know. The reason people write poetry isn't to win poetry awards. That all gets in the way. You know, sometimes I'll read a poem and I won't, you know, sometimes I'll read a poem and say, oh, that poem is really well put together. That is really a well-crafted poem. But sometimes I'll read a poem and it just blows me away, right? It's like, oh my God, that is such an amazing poem. I don't know if you've ever heard of a poem by Rilke, one of my favorite poets. And Rilke has a poem called, it's on a archaic torso of Apollo. And it's like 15 lines. But he says, he goes into a museum and he said, the head is gone. You know, they knock the head off and all that's left is this torso. And he says, when you look at this marble torso that has no head, it seems to glow from within. And he just basically says, you know, we connect when we look at that torso and we connect with that energy, we feel so alive. And at the end of the poem, he says, you know, you have to change your life. He says, you must change your life. These are like some of the most famous lines in poetry. And he says, you know, it's connecting with that energy that matters most. And he said, in fact, if the statue were intact, if it had a head and it had, you know, all of its parts, he said, that would actually detract. It's this fragment that we look at, this imperfect thing that seems to glow like a lamp, right? And it's really, it's setting us alight. It's setting us, it's making us radiant. So I would say that when people practice just to, you know, deal with the stress, good. you know, when people practice, when they go to the temple to see the Buddha statue, good. When they go to the temple and offer some incense because they have a big test the next day or they have a big report, good. That's most people in Asia do that, right? They just before exams, all of these Buddhists in China and Japan go to the temple and burn incense. It's like, dear, help me, Buddha, to get a good grade on my test, right? It's great. That's great. I'm glad they're helped, right? And maybe when they're taking their exam, they say, okay, be mindful. They watch the breath and they calm down and they get a better grade. Maybe they get a better grade, they get a scholarship, all good. But, you know, that's not really liberation. That's really not what it's all about. You know, it's not really what it's all about. It, you know, whether you are a householder, as Buddhists call it, you know, a person who has a family and a house and bills to pay, or you're a monk or a nun. Monks and nuns can also ruin their lives, right? They can be competitive too. Monks and nuns can also make themselves miserable by comparing themselves to others or setting standards for themselves that are unrealistic or judging their performance in certain ways. You know, the world is full of such people. If you go to a temple, there's a lot of competitiveness in temples too, right? Who can sit longer? Who, you know, that kind of thing. It's childish and it ruins everything. It's just like my wanting to have a, you know, the trophy every year. That's not transcendence. You know, this is about a man who goes to the temple and then he turns and walks away because it's not entering the temple that matters, right? It's getting beyond the small self. And I think when we do get beyond the small self, things get better anyway, right? It's like we don't have to try to make things better. It's like if I have to write something and I say to myself, this has to be a work of genius, you know, or this has to be the greatest thing anybody ever wrote on this subject, I'll start drinking like Hemingway. I don't drink, but if you say, I don't care what the outcome is, I'm going to give myself over to the process. I'm going to trust the process. I don't care about the outcome. I'm going to give myself wholeheartedly to this experience. It's like a lamp is lighted up in yourself, right? You are the light. The Buddha said, Atadipa, you are the light. What is that light? That is the light of transcendence, of not worrying about outcomes. Things become pure, they become bright and luminous when we no longer care about the outcome. If you sit down on the cushion and you say, I'm going to answer my koan, this sit or this sesshin, you're poisoning your life. When you say, I don't know what's going to happen, I'm going to sit down on the cushion and forget the self. See, now everything becomes bright and radiant, or can become bright and radiant. Not that your legs don't hurt, but you just sit through that and you transcend, right? It's about transcendence. And Engo, in his introduction, says as much. The blue sky, the bright sun. In Buddha mind, there is no east or west. See, no good or bad, no better, good, bad, better. Those are all absurd things that we create to make our lives miserable. Time and causation. Medicine must be given to the sick, right? I mean, tell me, is it best to let go or hold fast? See the following. Tokusan came to Isan's temple. Carrying his pilgrim's bundle under his arm, he crossed the lecture hall from east to west and from west to east. Then, staring around, he said, moo, moo, empty, empty, and went out. Tokusan reached the gate, but then said to himself, I should not be in such a hurry. So he dressed formally and entered a second time to have an interview. Isan was sitting in his place. Tokusan, holding up his kneeling cloth, said, Osho. Isan made as if to take up his whisk, his ceremonial whisk. Tokuzan, with his back turned on the lecture hall, put on his straw sandals and went off. In the evening, Isan asked the chief monk, "That new arrival, where is he?" The chief monk said, "When he went out, he turned his back on the lecture hall, put on his sandals, and went away." Isan said, "Someday that fellow will go to an isolated mountaintop, establish a hermitage, and scold the Buddhists and abuse the ancestors." See, in other words, he's got it. He knows it's not about the Nobel Prize. It's the transcendent experience of writing and not knowing where you're going. It's not getting the award as the best work of literary criticism for 2024. That is kind of a prison, right? I had a friend of mine who got the award. He was a young scholar. He got the award for the best literary book of literary criticism, and he actually could not write. He's retired now. He never wrote another book. He couldn't write another book because he couldn't match that book. This is the truth, so help me. He was a wonderful man. He wrote lots of articles and stuff, but he couldn't do it again. And so he couldn't free himself from his success. Isn't that amazing? But it's so human. See, it's about transcendence. Let your success go. Verse, the first seeing through, the second seeing through, frost on top of snow, great risk of slipping. Like General Hiki, he entered the enemy camp and narrowly escaped. He made a dash for it, but was not let alone. Alas, he is seated among the weeds on the isolated mountaintop. Remember that in Zen, the praise is often criticism, and criticism is mostly praise. So when he says he's sitting, alas, he's up in the Nowheresville, sitting on a mountaintop amid the weeds, he means he's fully arrived. He knows the secret.